It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. On November 9th, it will have been 20 years since Michael Bell Jr. was killed in an officer-involved shooting in Kenosha. Since his son's death in 2004, Michael Bell Sr. has been working to uncover the events of that night. In 2022, as part of his pursuit for more information, he filed a complaint against Attorney General Josh Call and Tina Virgil, the state's former criminal investigation administrator. He said they violated his rights as a crime victim by declining to order the release of relevant evidence and information. The state's Crime Victims' Rights Board ruled against him, saying the state was the victim in the case, though that decision will face more court challenges. Joe Neff is an investigative reporter at the Marshall Project. He recently published a feature detailing Bell's case. He and Michael Bell Sr. talked to Rob Ferret last week.
Michael, I think we need to start with the story of the loss of your son. I've talked to you. Can you recount that for us? Remind us what happened just about 20 years ago in Kenosha.
My son was coming home from a night out with friends. He arrived in front of his home. An officer pulled up behind him. Eventually, the officer got out of the car. My son got out of the car. There were some words exchanged. My son ran to the back of the house. To make a long story short, we believe an officer hooked his gun on a car mirror, and he misinterpreted it as my son. And while my son was bent over a car in handcuffs, another officer came up to him and put a gun directly to his temple and fired a bullet into my son's head while my daughter and his mother watched from just 10 feet away.
And Michael, you've told me in the past and others that at the time you were not the sort of person who would doubt a police account of an event like this. You grew to doubt it very much over time. Can you talk about what led you to a question and then start challenging and investigating the police account of what happened?
I need your listeners to understand that I'm a retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel. I flew wars for our country, and I had so much honor and integrity in my own uniform that I expected those in government around me to have the same. When I heard my daughter recount the version of what she saw that night, I couldn't believe it. I didn't even believe my own child. But trying to keep my family put together, we went to counseling. And during deep counseling sessions with Michael's mother and myself and my daughter, I recognized that these ladies were telling the absolute truth. And about that same time, other evidence was coming in to show that the police version of the shooting was inaccurate.
Joe, you've covered stories related to police and prison accountability in the past. What drew you to write for the Marshall Project about Michael Bell Sr. and his latest legal efforts?
Well, the thing that initially drew me to this, there is a certain man-bites-dog quality. I received a phone call from someone who told me that there's a man whose son was killed by police in Wisconsin, and it went to the State Victims' Rights Board, which ruled that if there was a victim in this case, it wasn't Mr. Bell, it was the government. And that was really bizarre to me because I've been following the victims' rights movement through my work for decades now, and I've never heard that the government is a victim in a crime.
And Michael, let's pick up the story there. As part of your effort to get at all relevant records, get at every possible angle on what happened in November 20 years ago, you filed a complaint, this is a couple of years ago, against Attorney General Josh Call and Tina Virgil, the state's criminal investigation administrator, saying that your rights as a victim had been violated. Can you talk about that legal angle, that legal avenue you're pursuing?
It all started with a local DA telling a judge when we requested a John Doe hearing that the state crime lab had verified his position that they didn't expect to see any DNA on the officer's gun. And we were like, are you telling me that the first DA said that there was a life and death struggle, that essentially my son was supposedly grabbing an officer's weapon and there was no DNA. And so we asked for the records on who that crime analyst was for the Department of Justice, and Josh Call refused to turn over any of that information. So I went to Governor Evers. I contacted him, and he said there was nothing he could do, but his senior legal counsel at the time suggested that we make a complaint with the Crimes Victims Rights Board. And that's how it started. At the time that Marcy's Law came into being, crime victims had actually less rights than the people that committed the crime. Marcy's Law ensures that victims of a crime have equal constitutional rights on the same level as those accused and convicted of the crime. So we made a complaint with the Crimes Victims Rights Board. And then the ruling at the end come out and said that we were not the victim of a crime, but the government, even though there might have been police misconduct, is the victim of a crime.
Joe, as you mentioned, you followed these victims' rights laws. How unique is this case, this challenge from Michael invoking a Wisconsin's version of victims' rights law, Marcy's Law, as he just mentioned?
I have not heard of a case like this where the government is the victim. The victims' rights movement started because police and prosecutors were ignoring victims, that the only role that a victim would have in court was to be a witness. And it was victims' job to show up in court and testify. But that did not recognize the humanity of what crime victims have gone through. So over time, states have all passed some sort of victims' rights laws, but you have the right to know what's going on in the case. Has someone been charged? What is the investigation showing? If there's a court hearing, you have the right to be heard. You have the right to input. And none of those rights applies to the government. I've called around to a lot of law professors, and it seems to be that no victims' rights board or agency has issued something like this elsewhere.
We are talking about victims' rights in the case of Michael Bell Jr., shot fatally by Kenosha police just shy of 20 years ago. His father, Michael Bell Sr., is with us. Also, Joe Neff, investigative reporter at the Marshall Project. Michael, this ruling is not the last word, as I understand it. What will you do now to try to invoke your rights as a victim and to try to get this information?
Right now, we have an interested pro bono attorney that's going to take the appeal on this to the next step. And so that's why it should be headed to the Court of Appeals very shortly.
Michael, if the court system ends up agreeing with you, saying, yes, you are the victim of a crime, of what you say is a cover-up by police and others, what then will you be able to do with that? What are your hopes for the ability then to get more of the information you've been looking for all these years?
Well, I'm really glad you brought that up, Rob, because one of the most important pieces of evidence right now is being held closely by the city of Kenosha. A bullet that was involved with killing my son wants to be investigated by a national renowned ballistics expert. We found the bullet in impact location. It is in direct opposition to the police version of the shooting. That bullet impact location tested positive for lead. We feel that if we have the bullet, we can match it to that bullet impact location, and it's going to completely blow the police version of the story apart, but the city refuses to release the bullet. I want to tell you, I went as far as to offer a financial indemnification agreement that if something was found because of that, the city would be found harmless. I went as far as to offer $200,000 to Kenosha charities if the city of Kenosha will release that bullet for outside examination, and the city of Kenosha refuses. There aren't really any regulations regarding evidence. A police department can discard evidence anytime they want to. And the problem is what happens if they discard evidence that might be incriminating against that police department? So we're very, very worried that that bullet is not going to be preserved. And so Friday the 1st, one of our investigators is a retired police detective. His name is Russell Beckman. He will be at the public safety building in Kenosha doing a records review of the whole matter. And along with him will be a process server. And that process server will be giving the Public Works and Joint Services an order asking for preservation of that bullet. And so it is a big event. And we have no idea how the city's going to respond. Are they going to welcome us in? They're going to shoo us away? We don't know, but we're going to be taking a look at all the records associated with my son's death and that bullet. I believe that if this comes in our favor, then we can bring this to a new John Doe, and we can eventually get that bullet investigated properly.
Joe, as you've mentioned, this is in some ways a very unique case when it comes to victims' rights laws. But as Michael has suggested, there could be a lot at stake for future issues, especially when somebody in government could be accused of a crime. What do you see as being at stake in this particular court challenge?
One of the things is that is at stake is the ability of someone like Michael Bell to tell a prosecutor or police or a city what to do, or to win that right to have the city share the bullet so that it can be forensically examined. A lot of the rights that have been recognized are rights to speak and be heard for victims. So this is very interesting. Do I have a right to tell the police or the city what to do?
And Joe, stepping away from the particulars of the case, is there a concern about police department transparency? When this information is there, there's maybe a public interest in seeking it and having it released. Is this something that you think has some wider lessons?
Oh, yes. If you think about all the cases where people are shot and killed by police, oftentimes these are wrongful, even criminal uses of force. A crime victim or the person's family should have the right to get all of the information about what happened that day to prevent these type of things from happening in the future and to hold the wrongdoers accountable.
Michael, I want to revisit some of our past conversations. Of course, over the last 20 years, you've been pursuing the full story of what happened to your son. You've been doing more than that, too, largely because of your efforts, in some cases in partnership with others. Laws in Wisconsin have been changed. Rules have been changed when it comes to how police-involved shootings are investigated. Can you remind us some of the changes that have happened in large part because of your efforts?
Well, I was appalled when I found out that the police department that was involved in the shooting actually investigated it itself. And I talked to current law enforcement today, and they can't believe that that was actually a rule that they could live by. As a retired military officer and a pilot, if my squadron crashed an aircraft, our squadron would do its own internal review, but it would never conduct the safety investigation. So I worked very hard with a number of other advocates, and in 2013, the law was changed, and Wisconsin became the first state in the nation that required all fatal police-involved shootings to be investigated by an outside agency. And another thing that we worked on is that I always felt that police-involved shootings should be reviewed like the National Transportation Safety Board reviews on aircraft mishap. What should happen is look at what happened, all the underlying causes, and if something could be changed, let's do it so that way that the accident doesn't happen again. Our investigative team strongly believes that a holster that a police officer wore that had what was called a jacket gap, so the jacket could fit between his gun and his utility belt, it's U-shaped, and it perfectly fit over a driver's side mirror. If they had the NTSB model of review, they would go back to the drawing board and say, wait a minute, this utility belt, the way it's designed, could be misinterpreted and somebody could lose their life over it, whether it be a police officer or a civilian. So we were able to have a major conference at Wingspread, S.E. Johnson, with law enforcement and National Transportation Safety Board and NASA, and we talked about this open type review. And those are just some of the things that we've been involved with. The last count that I heard, 8 other states have now adopted a version of the Wisconsin law requiring outside investigation of police shootings.
Joe, what are you watching for next in Michael's story?
Well, I'm waiting to see how the city of Kenosha will respond, unless they have decided not to share the bullet for review. But I think that since they are a government that responds to the voters, I would hope that at some point that might be revisited. There is no harm that I can see in examining a bullet and giving it to forensic evidence to see what the facts are. as a journalist, the more information in the public, the better. The more transparency for police and law enforcement, the better. And I do think that this idea that Michael's talking about convening real investigations like the National Transportation Safety Board does in airplane accidents would be really useful, because the whole goal is to prevent future accidents. And I think that in police shootings or in wrongful convictions, which are every wrongful conviction is a plane crash in and of itself, so to speak, that if we went back and looked at it, not to seek out blame, but to prevent people from being harmed in the future, I think that would be valuable for society.
Michael, you're still trying to correct the record, find the full story from 20 years ago. Do you feel like, in part because of those law changes you mentioned, a shooting today, God forbid, if it were to happen, would be investigated more fully? There would be more transparency?
I believe so. There's a lot of loose ends. You know, you can have reciprocal agreements between the police departments. I know that when our law came into effect, that some of the police departments said, you know, we're never going to let such and such police department investigate us because we don't trust them, we don't like them, so we are going to pick out a friendly department. So I do think there's improvement. One of the things that I think is important with the National Transportation Safety Board style investigation is right now the numbers show that approximately 35% of police-involved shootings are mistake of fact. Something was misperceived and somebody died over it. And if we do a proper National Transportation Safety Style investigation, we might be able to bring that number down to 20% or 15%. And each time that we do that, we help the relationship between law enforcement and the community. We build better trust. And that's why I think it's so important that we continue to push forward with these types of reforms.
Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Joe, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Michael Bell Sr., a victims' rights activist and former Air Force pilot. He's the father of Michael Bell Jr., who was killed by Kenosha police in 2004. Joe Neff is an investigative reporter at the Marshall Project. That's a criminal justice journalism nonprofit. His feature about Bell's case was published in collaboration with WPR. Wisconsin Public Radio is bringing you live special coverage this election night. You can join us tonight starting at 6. We'll share results and analysis from Wisconsin's biggest races as they come in and NPR updates from across the country. After the polls close in Wisconsin at 8, join my Wisconsin Today colleague Rob Ferret and WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson. They will be anchoring our state's election coverage and keep you up to date on returns. Again, that's live coverage on this election night here on WPR and at WPR.org. Join us starting at 6.